This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Right Stuff, written by Tom Wolfe, performed by Dennis Quaid.
Forward. This book grew out of some ordinary curiosity. What is it, I wondered, that makes a man willing to sit up on top of an enormous Roman candle, such as a Redstone, Atlas, Titan, or Saturn rocket, and wait for someone to light the fuse? I decided on the simplest approach possible. I would ask a few astronauts and find out. So I asked a few in December of 1972 when they gathered at Cape Canaveral to watch the last mission to the moon, Apollo 17. I discovered, quickly enough, that none of them, no matter how talkative otherwise, was about to answer the question, or even linger for more than a few seconds on the subject at the heart of it, which is to say, courage. But I did sense that the answer was not to be found in any of traits specific to the task of flying into space. The great majority of the astronauts who had flown the rockets had come from the ranks of test pilots. All but a few had been military test pilots, and even those few, such as Neil Armstrong, had been trained in the military. And it was this that led me to a rich and fabulous terrain that, in a literary sense, had remained as dark as the far side of a moon for more than half a century: military flying and the modern American officer corps. Immediately following the First World War, a certain fashion set in among writers in Europe and soon spread to their obedient colonial counterparts in the United States. War was looked upon as inherently monstrous, and those who waged it, namely military officers, were looked upon as brutes and Philistines. The tone was set by some brilliant novels, among them All Quiet on the Western Front, The Journey to the End of the Night, and The Good Soldier, Schweik. The only proper protagonist for a tale of war was an enlisted man, and he was to be presented not as a hero, but as every man, as much a victim of the war as any civilian. Any officer above the rank of second lieutenant was to be presented as a martinet or a fool, if not an outright villain, no matter whom he fought for. The old-fashioned tale of prowess and heroism was relegated to second and third-rate forms of literature, ghost-written autobiographies, and stories in pulp magazines on the order of Argosy and Blue Book. Even as late as the 1930s, the favorite war stories in the pulps concerned World War I pilots. One of the few scientific treatises ever written on the subject of bravery is The Anatomy of Courage by Charles Moran, who served as a doctor in the trenches for the British in World War I, and who was better known later as Lord Moran, personal physician to Winston Churchill. Writing in the 1920s, Moran predicted that in the wars of the future, adventurous young men who sought glory in war would tend to seek it as pilots. In the 20th century, he said, they would regard the military pilot as the quintessence of manly daring that the cavalryman had been in the 19th. Serious treatment of the drama and psychology of this new pursuit, flying high-performance aircraft in battle, was left to the occasional pilot who could write, the most notable of them being Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. The literary world remained oblivious. Nevertheless, young men did exactly what Moran predicted. They became military officers so they could fly, and they flew against astonishingly deadly odds. As late as 1970, I was to discover in an article by a military doctor in a medical journal, a career Navy pilot faced a 23% likelihood of dying in an accident. This did not even include deaths in combat, which at the time, with the war in Vietnam in progress, were catastrophically high for Navy pilots. The Right Stuff became the story of why men were witting, delighted, to take on such odds in this, an era literary people had long since characterized as the age of the anti-hero. Such was the psychological mystery that animated me in the writing of this book. And if there were those readers who were not interested in the exploration of space per se, but who were interested in the right stuff nonetheless, perhaps it might have been because the mystery caught their imagination as well as mine. Since this book was first published in 1979, I have enjoyed corresponding with many pilots and with many widows of pilots. Not all have written to pat me on the back, but almost all seem grateful that someone had tried, and it had to be an outsider, to put into words certain matters that the very code of the pilot rules off limits in conversation. These matters add up to one of the most extraordinary and most secret dramas of the 20th century. T.W., August 1983. Chapter 1. The Angels. Within 5 minutes or 10 minutes, no more than that, three of the others had called her on the telephone to ask her if she had heard that something had happened out there. "Jane, this is Alice. Listen, I just got a call from Betty, and she said that she heard something's happened out there. Have you heard anything?" That was the way they phrased it, call after call. She picked up the telephone and began relaying the same message to some of the others. "Connie, this is Jane Conrad. Alice just called me, and she says something's happened." Something was part of the official wife lingo for tiptoeing blindfolded around the subject. Being barely 21 years old and new around here, Jane Conrad knew very little about this particular subject since nobody ever talked about it. But the day was young, and what a setting she had for her imminent enlightenment, and what a picture she herself presented. Jane was tall and slender and had rich brown hair and high cheekbones and wide brown eyes. She looked like the actress Jean Simmons. Her father was a rancher in southwestern Texas. She had gone east to college to Bryn Mawr and had met her husband Pete at a debutante's party at the Gulf Mills Club in Philadelphia when he was a senior at Princeton. Pete was a short, wiry, blonde boy who joked around a lot. At any moment, his face was likely to break into a wild grin, revealing the gap between his front teeth. The hickory kid sort he was, a hickory kid on the Deb circuit, however. He had an air of energy, self-confidence, ambition, joie de vivre. Jane and Pete were married 2 days after he graduated from Princeton. Last year, Jane gave birth to their first child, Peter. And today, here in Florida, in Jacksonville, in the peaceful year 1955, the sun shines through the pines outside, and the very air takes on the sparkle of the ocean. The ocean and the great Michael White Beach are less than a mile away. Anyone driving by will see Jane's little house gleaming like a dream house in the pines. It is a brick house, but Jane and Pete painted the bricks white so that it gleams in the sun against a great green screen of pine trees with a thousand little places where the sun peeks through. They painted the shutters black, which makes the white walls look even more brilliant. The house has only 1,100 square feet of floor space, but Jane and Pete designed it for themselves, and that more than makes up for the size. A friend of theirs was the builder and gave them every possible break so that it cost only $11,000. Outside, the sun shines, and inside, the fever rises by the minute as 5, 10, 15, and finally nearly all 20 of the wives join the circuit, trying to find out what has happened, which in fact means to whose husband. After 30 minutes on such a circuit, this is not an unusual morning around here. A wife begins to feel that the telephone is no longer located on a table or on the kitchen wall. It is exploding in her solar plexus. Yet it would be far worse right now to hear the front doorbell. The protocol is strict on that point, although written down nowhere. No woman is supposed to deliver the final news, and certainly not on the telephone. The matter mustn't be bungled. That's the idea. No, a man should bring the news when the time comes, a man with some official or moral authority, a clergyman or a comrade of the newly deceased. Furthermore, he should bring the bad news in person. He should turn up at the front door and ring the bell and be standing there like the pillar of coolness and competence, bearing the bad news on ice, like a fish. Therefore, all the telephone calls from the wives were the frantic and portentous beating of the wings of the death angels, as it were. When the final news came, there would be a ring at the front door. A wife in this situation finds herself staring at the front door as if she no longer owns or controls it. And outside the door would be a man, come to inform her that, unfortunately, something has happened out there, and her husband's body now lies incinerated in the swamps or the pines or the palmetto grass, burned beyond recognition. Which anyone who had been around an airbase for very long, fortunately Jane had not, realized was quite an artful euphemism to describe a human body that now looked like an enormous fowl that has burned up in a stove. Burned a blackish brown all over, greasy and blistered, fried, in a word, with not only the entire face and all the hair and the ears burned off, not to mention all the clothing, but also the hands and feet, and what remains of the arms and legs bent at the knees and elbows and burned into absolutely rigid angles, burned a greasy blackish brown like the bursting body itself. So that this husband, father, officer, gentleman, this ornamentum of some mother's eye, His Majesty the baby of just 20-odd years back, has been reduced to a charred hulk with wings and shanks sticking out of it. My own husband, how could this be what they were talking about? Jane had heard the young men, Pete among them, talk about the other men who had bought it or augured in or crunched, but it had never been anyone they knew. No one in the squadron, and in any event, the way they talked about it with such breezy, slangy terminology was the same way they talked about sports. It was as if they were saying he was thrown out stealing second base, and that was all. Not one word, not in print, not in conversation, not in this amputated language about an incinerated corpse from which a young man's spirit has vanished in an instant, from which all smiles, gestures, moods, worries, laughter, wiles, shrugs, tenderness, and loving looks. You, my love, have disappeared like a sigh, while the terror consumes a cottage in the woods, and a young woman, sizzling with fever, awaits her confirmation as the new widow of the day. The next series of calls greatly increased the possibility that it was Pete to whom something had happened. There were only 20 men in the squadron, and soon 9 or 10 had been accounted for by the fluttering reports of the death angels. Knowing that the word was out that an accident had occurred, husbands who could get to a telephone were calling home to say, "It didn't happen to me." This news, of course, was immediately fed to the fever. Jane's telephone would ring once more, and one of those wives would be saying, "Nancy just got a call from Jack. He's at the squadron, and he says something's happened, but he doesn't know what. He said he saw Frank D. take off about 10 minutes ago with Greg in back, so they're all right. What have you heard?" But Jane has heard nothing, except that other husbands, and not hers, are safe and accounted for. And thus, on a sunny day in Florida, outside of the Jacksonville Naval Air Station, in a little white cottage, a veritable dream house, another beautiful young woman was about to be apprised of the quid pro quo of her husband's line of work. Of the trade-off, as one might say. The subparagraphs of a contract written in no visible form. Just as surely as if she had the entire roster in front of her, Jane now realized that only 2 men in the squadron were unaccounted for. One was a pilot named Bud Jennings. The other was Pete. She picked up the telephone and did something that was much frowned on in a time of emergency. She called the squadron office. The duty officer answered. "I want to speak to Lieutenant Conrad," said Jane. "This is Mrs. Conrad. "I'm sorry," the duty officer said, and then his voice cracked. "I'm sorry, I..." He couldn't find the words. He was about to cry. He can't come to the phone. He can't come to the phone. "It's very important," said Jane. "I'm sorry. It's impossible." The duty officer could hardly get the words out because he was so busy gulping back sobs. Sobs. "He can't come to the phone." "Why not? Where is he?" "I'm sorry." More sighs, wheezes, snuffling gasp. "I can't tell you that. I have to hang up now." And the duty officer's voice disappeared in a great surf of emotion, and he hung up. The duty officer. The very sound of her voice was more than he could take. The world froze, congealed in that moment. Jane could no longer calculate the interval before the front doorbell would ring and some competent, long-faced figure would appear, some friend of widows and orphans who would inform her, officially, that Pete was dead. Even out in the middle of the swamp, in this rot bog of pine trunks, scum slicks, dead daughter vines and mosquito eggs, even out in this great overripe sump, the smell of burn beyond recognition obliterated everything else. When the airplane fuel exploded, it created a heat so intense that everything but the hardest metals not only burned, everything of rubber, plastic, celluloid, wood, leather, cloth, flesh, gristle, calcium, horn, hair, blood, and protoplasm. It not only burned, it gave up the ghost in the form of every stricken putrid gas known to chemistry. One could smell the horror. It came in through the nostrils and burned the rhinal cavities raw and penetrated the liver and permeated the bowels like a black gas until there was nothing in the universe, inside or out, except the stench of the char. As the helicopter came down between the pine trees and settled into the bogs, the smell hit Pete Conrad even before the hatch was completely open, and they were not even close enough to see the wreckage yet. The rest of the way, Conrad and the crewmen had to travel on foot. After a few steps, the water was up to their knees, and then it was up to the armpits, and they kept wading through the water, and the scum, and the vines, and the pine trunks, but it was nothing compared to the smell. Conrad, a 25-year-old lieutenant, junior grade, happened to be on duty as squadron safety officer that day and was supposed to make the on-site investigation of the crash. The fact was, however, that this squadron was the first duty assignment of his career, and he had never been at a crash site before, and he had never smelled any such revolting stench or seen anything like what awaited him. When Conrad finally reached the plane, which was an SNJ, he found the fuselage burned and blistered and dug into the swamp with one wing sheared off and the cockpit canopy smashed. In the front seat was all that was left of his friend, Bud Jennings. Bud Jennings, an amiable fellow, a promising young fighter pilot, was now a horrible roasted hulk with no head. His head was completely gone, apparently torn off the spinal column like a pineapple off a stalk, except that it was nowhere to be found. Conrad stood there, soaking wet in the swamp bog, wondering what the hell to do. It was a struggle to move 20 feet in this freaking muck. Every time he looked up, he was looking into a delirium of limbs, vines, dappled shadows, and a chopped-up white light that came through the treetops. The ubiquitous screen of trees with a thousand little places where the sun peeked through. Nevertheless, he started wading back into the muck and the scum, and the others followed. He kept looking up. Gradually, he could make it out. Up in the treetops, there was a pattern of broken limbs where the SNJ had come crashing through. It was like a tunnel through the treetops. Conrad and the others began splashing through the swamp, following the strange path 90 or 100 feet above them. It took a sharp turn. That must have been where the wing broke off. The trail veered to one side and started downward. They kept looking up and wading through the muck. Then they stopped. There was a great green sapwound up there in the middle of a tree trunk. It was odd. Near the huge gash, tree disease. Some sort of brownish lumpy sac up in the branches, such as you see in trees infested with bagworms, and there were yellowish curds on the branches around it, as if the disease had caused the sap to ooze out and fester and congeal, except that it couldn't be sap, because it was streaked with blood. In the next instant, Conrad didn't have to say a word. Each man could see it all. The lumpy sac was the cloth liner of a flight helmet, with the earphones attached to it. The curds were Bud Jennings' brains. The tree trunk had smashed through the cockpit canopy of the SNJ and knocked Bud Jennings' head to pieces like a melon. In keeping with the protocol, the squadron commander was not going to release Bud Jennings' name until his widow, Loretta, had been located and a competent male death messenger had been dispatched to tell her. But Loretta Jennings was not at home and could not be found, hence a delay, and more than enough time for the other wives, the death angels, to burn with panic over the telephone lines. All the pilots were accounted for except the two who were in the woods, Bud Jennings and Pete Conrad. One chance in two, AC-DC, one finger, two finger, and this was not an unusual day around here. Loretta Jennings had been out at a shopping center. When she returned home, a certain figure was waiting outside, a man, a solemn friend of widows and orphans. And it was Loretta Jennings who lost the game of odd and even, AC-DC. And it was Loretta whose child, she was pregnant with a second, would have no father. It was this young woman who went through all the final horrors that Jane Conrad had imagined, assumed, would be hers to endure forever. Yet this grim stroke of fortune brought Jane little relief. On the day of Bud Jennings' funeral, Pete went into the back of the closet and brought out his bridge coat, per regulations. This was the most stylish item in the Navy officer's wardrobe. Pete had never had occasion to wear this before. It was a double-breasted coat made of navy blue melton cloth and came down almost to the ankles. It must have weighed 10 pounds. It had a double row of gold buttons down the front and loops for shoulder boards. Big, beautiful belly-cut collar and lapels, deep turnbacks on the sleeves, a tailored waist, and a center vent in back that ran from the waistline to the bottom of the coat. Never would Pete, or for that matter, any other American males in the mid-20th century, have an article of clothing quite so impressive and aristocratic as that bridge coat. At the funeral, the 19 little Indians who were left, Navy boys, lined up manfully in their bridge coats. They looked so young. Their pink, lineless faces with their absolutely clear, lean jawlines popped up bravely, correctly, out of the enormous belly-cut collars of the bridge coats. They sang an old Navy hymn, which slipped into a strange and lugubrious minor key here and there, and included a stanza added especially for aviators. It ended with, "O hear us when we lift our prayer for those in peril in the air." 3 months later, another member of the squadron crashed and was burned beyond recognition, and Pete hauled out the bridge coat again, and Jane saw 18 little Indians bravely going through the motions at the funeral. Not long after that, Pete was transferred from Jacksonville to the Patuxent River Naval Air Station in Maryland. Pete and Jane had barely settled in there when they got word that another member of the Jacksonville squadron, a close friend of theirs, someone they had had over to dinner many times, had died trying to take off from the deck of a carrier in a routine practice session a few miles out in the Atlantic. The catapult that propelled aircraft off the deck lost pressure, and his ship just dribbled off the end of the deck, with his engine roaring vainly, and fell 60 feet into the ocean and sank like a brick. And he vanished. Just like that. Pete had been transferred to Patuxent River, which was known in Navy vernacular as Pax River, to enter the Navy's new test pilot school. This was considered a major step up in the career of a young Navy aviator. Now that the Korean War was over and there was no combat flying, all the hot young pilots aimed for flight test. In the military, they always said flight test and not test flying. Jet aircraft had been in use for barely 10 years at the time, and the Navy was testing new jet fighters continually. Pax River was the Navy's prime test center. Jane liked the house they bought at Pax River. She didn't like it as much as the little house in Jacksonville, but then she and Pete hadn't designed this one. They lived in a little community called Northdown Creek, 6 miles from the base. Northdown Creek, like the base, was on a scrub pine peninsula that stuck out into Chesapeake Bay. They were tucked in among the pine trees. Once more, all around were rhododendron bushes. Pete's classwork and his flying duties were very demanding. Everyone in his flight test class, Group 20, talked about how difficult it was and obviously loved it, because in Navy flying, this was the big league. The young men in Group 20 and their wives were Pete's and Jane's entire social world. They associated with no one else. They constantly invited each other to dinner during the week. There was a group party at someone's house practically every weekend, and they would go off on outings to fish or water ski in Chesapeake Bay. In a way, they could not have associated with anyone else, at least not easily, because the boys could only talk about one thing, their flying. One of the phrases that kept running through the conversation was pushing the outside of the envelope. The envelope was a flight test term referring to the limits of a particular aircraft's performance, how tight a turn it could make at such and such a speed, and so on. Pushing the outside, probing the outer limits of the envelope, seemed to be the great challenge and satisfaction of flight test. At first, pushing the outside of the envelope was not a particularly terrifying phrase to hear. It sounded once more as if the boys were just talking about sports. Then one sunny day, a member of the group, one of the happy lads they always had dinner with and drank with and went water skiing with, was coming in for a landing at the base in an A-3J attack plane. He had let his airspeed fall too low before he extended his flaps, and the ship stalled out, and he crashed and was burned beyond recognition. And they brought out the bridge coats and sang about those in peril in the air and put the bridge coats away, and the Indians who were left talked about the accident after dinner one night. They shook their heads and said it was a damn shame, but he should have known better than to wait so long before lowering his flaps. Barely a week had gone by before another member of the group was coming in for a landing in the same type of aircraft, the A-3J, making a 90-degree turn on his final approach, and something went wrong with the controls, and he ended up with one rear stabilizer wing up and the other one down, and his ship rolled in like a corkscrew from 800 feet and crashed, and he was burned beyond recognition. And the bridge coats came out, and they sang about those in peril in the air. And then they put the bridge coats away, and after dinner one night they mentioned that the departed had been a good man, but was inexperienced. And when the malfunction in the controls put him in that bad corner, he didn't know how to get out of it. Every wife wanted to cry out, "Well, my God, the machine broke. What makes any of you think that you would have come out any better?" Yet, intuitively, Jane and the rest of them knew it wasn't right to even suggest that. Pete never indicated for a moment that he thought any such thing could possibly happen to him. It seemed not only wrong but dangerous to challenge a young pilot's confidence by posing the question. And that, too, was part of the unofficial protocol for the officer's wife. From now on, every time Pete was late coming in from the flight line, she would worry. She began to wonder if, no, assume, he had found his way into one of those corners they all talked about so spiritedly. One of those little dead ends that so enliven conversation around here. Not long after that, another good friend of theirs went up in an F-4, the Navy's newest and hottest fighter plane, known as the Phantom. He reached 20,000 feet and then nosed over and dove straight into the Chesapeake Bay. It turned out that a hose connection was missing in his oxygen system, and he had suffered hypoxia and passed out at the high altitude. And the bridge coats came out, and they lifted a prayer about those in peril in the air, and the bridge coats were put away, and the little Indians were incredulous. How could anybody fail to check his hose connections? And how could anybody be in such poor condition as to pass out that quickly from hypoxia? A couple of days later, Jane was standing at the window of her house in Northdown Creek. She saw some smoke rise above the pines from over in the direction of the flight line. Just that, a column of smoke. No explosion or sirens or any other sound. She went to another room, so as not to have to think about it, but there was no explanation for the smoke. She went back to the window. In the yard of a house across the street, she saw a group of people standing there and looking at her house, as if trying to decide what to do. Jane looked away, but she couldn't keep from looking out again. She caught a glimpse of a certain figure coming up the walkway toward her front door. She knew exactly who it was. She had had nightmares like this. Yet this was no dream. She was wide awake and alert, never more alert in her entire life. Frozen completely by the sight, she simply waited for the bell to ring. She waited, but there was not a sound. Finally, she could stand it no more. In real life, unlike her dream life, Jane was both too self-possessed and too polite to scream through the door, "Go away!" So she opened it. There was no one there. No one at all. There was no group of people on the lawn across the way, and no one to be seen for 100 yards in any direction along the lawns and leafy rhododendron roads of Northtown Creek. Then began a cycle in which she had both the nightmares and the hallucinations continually. Anything could touch off an hallucination. A ball of smoke, a telephone ring that stopped before she could answer it, the sound of a siren, even the sound of trucks starting up, crash trucks. Then she would glance out the window, and a certain figure would be coming up the walk, and she would wait for the bell. The only difference between the dreams and the hallucinations was that the scene of the dreams was always the little white house in Jacksonville. In both cases, the feeling that this time it has happened was quite real. The star pilot in the class behind Pete's, a young man who was the main rival of their good friend Al Bean, went up in a fighter to do some power dive test. One of the most demanding disciplines in flight tests was to accustom yourself to making precise readings from the control panel in the same moment that you were pushing the outside of the envelope. The young man put his ship into the test dive and was still reading out the figures with diligence and precision and great discipline when he augured straight into the Oyster Flats and was burned beyond recognition. And the bridge coats came out, and they sang about those in peril in the air, and the bridge coats were put away. And the little Indians remarked that the departed was a swell guy, and a brilliant student of flying. A little too much of a student, in fact. He hadn't bothered to look out the window at the real world soon enough. Beano, Al Bean, wasn't quite so brilliant. On the other hand, he was still here. Like many other wives in Group 20, Jane wanted to talk about the whole situation, the incredible series of fatal accidents with her husband and other members of the group, to find out how they were taking it. But somehow, the unwritten protocol forbade discussions of this subject, which was the fear of death. Nor could Jane or any of the rest of them talk, really have a talk, with anyone around the base. You could talk to another wife about being worried, but what good did it do? Who wasn't worried? You were likely to get a look that said, "Why dwell on it?" Jane might have gotten away with divulging the matter of the nightmares. But hallucinations? There was no room in Navy life for such anomalous tendency as that. By now, the bad string had reached 10 in all, and almost all of the dead had been close friends of Pete and Jane, young men who had been in their house many times young men who had sat across from Jane and chattered, like the rest of them, about the grand adventure of military flying. And the survivors still sat around, as before, with the same inexplicable exhilaration. Jane kept watching Pete for some sign that his spirit was cracking, but she saw none. He talked a mile a minute, kidded and joked, laughed with his hickory kid cackle. He always had. He still enjoyed the company of members of the group like Wally Schirra and Jim Lovell. Many young pilots were taciturn and cut loose with the strange fervor of this business only in the air. But Pete and Wally and Jim were not reticent, not in any situation. They loved to kid around. Pete called Jim Lovell shaky because it was the last thing a pilot would want to be called. Wally Schirra was outgoing to the point of hearty. He loved practical jokes and dreadful puns and so on. The three of them, even in the midst of this bad string, would love to get on a subject such as accident-prone Mitch Johnson. Accident-prone Mitch Johnson, it seemed, was a Navy pilot whose life was in the hands of two angels, one of them bad and the other one good. The bad angel would put him into accidents that would have annihilated any ordinary pilot, and the good angel would bring him out of them without a scratch. Just the other day, this was the sort of story Jane would hear them tell. Mitch Johnson was coming into land on a carrier, but he came in short, missed the flight deck, and crashed into the fantail below the deck. There was a tremendous explosion, and the rear half of the plane fell into the water in flames. Everyone on the flight deck said, "Poor Johnson, the good angel was off duty." They were still debating on how to remove the debris and his mortal remains when a phone rang on the bridge. A somewhat dopey voice said, "This is Johnson. Say, listen, I'm down here in the supply hold and the hatch is locked and I can't find the lights and I can't see a goddamn thing and I tripped over a cable and I think I hurt my leg." The officer on the bridge slammed the phone down, then vowed to find out what morbid son of a bitch could pull a phone prank at a time like this. Then the phone rang again, and the man with the dopey voice managed to establish the fact that he was indeed Mitch Johnson. The good angel had not left his side. When he smashed into the fantail, he hit some ammunition drums, and they cushioned the impact, leaving him groggy but not seriously hurt. The fuselage had been blown to pieces, so he just stepped out onto the fantail and opened a hatch that led into the supply hold. It was pitch black in there. Then there were cables all across the floor, holding down spare aircraft engines. Accident-prone, Mitch Johnson kept tripping over these cables until he found a telephone. Sure enough, the one injury he had was a bruised shin from tripping over a cable. The man was accident-prone. Pete and Wally and Jim absolutely cracked up over stories like this. It was amazing. Great sports yarns. Nothing more than that. A few days later, Jane was out shopping at the Pax River Commissary on Saunders Road, near the main gate to the base. She heard the sirens go off at the field, and then she heard the engines of the crash truck start up. This time, Jane was determined to keep calm. Every instinct made her want to rush home, but she forced herself to stay in the commissary and continue shopping. For 30 minutes, she went through the motions of completing her shopping list. Then she drove home to Northtown Creek. As she reached the house, she saw a figure going up the sidewalk. It was a man. Even from the back, there was no question as to who it was. He had on a black suit, and there was a white band around his neck. It was her minister from the Episcopal Church. She stared, and this vision did not come and go. The figure kept on walking up the front walk. She was not asleep now, and she was not inside her house glancing out the front window. She was outside in her car in front of her house. She was not dreaming, and she was not hallucinating, and the figure kept walking up toward her front door. The commotion at the field was over one of the most extraordinary things that even veteran pilots had ever seen at Pax River. And they had all seen it, because practically the entire flight line had gathered out on the field for it, as if it had been an air show. Conrad's friend, Ted Whelan, had taken a fighter up, and on takeoff there had been a structural failure that caused a hydraulic leak. A red warning light showed up on Whelan's panel, and he had a talk with the ground. It was obvious that the leak would cripple the controls before he could get the ship back down onto the field for a landing. He would have to bail out. The only question was where and when. And so they had a talk about that. They decided that he should jump at 8,100 feet at such and such a speed directly over the field. The plane would crash into Chesapeake Bay, and he would float down to the field. Just as coolly as anyone could have asked for, Ted Whelan lined the ship up to come across the field at 8,100 feet precisely, and he punched out, ejected. Down on the field, they all had their faces turned up to the sky. They saw Whelan pop out of the cockpit. With his Martin Baker seat parachute rig strapped on, he looked like a little black geometric lump a mile and a half up in the blue. They watched him as he started dropping. Everyone waited for the parachute to open. They waited a few more seconds. And then they waited some more. The little shape was getting bigger and bigger and picking up tremendous speed. Then there was an unspeakable instant at which everyone on the field who knew anything about parachute jumps knew what was going to happen. Yet even for them, it was an unearthly feeling, for no one had ever seen any such thing happen close up from start to finish, from what amounted to a grandstand seat. Now the shape was going so fast and coming so close it began to play tricks on the eyes. It seemed to stretch out. It became much bigger and hurtled toward them at a terrific speed, until they couldn't make out its actual outlines at all. Finally, there was just a streaking black blur before their eyes, followed by what seemed like an explosion, except that it was not an explosion. It was the tremendous crack of Ted Whelan, his helmet, his pressure suit, and his seat parachute rig smashing into the center of the runway, precisely on target, right in front of the crowd, an absolute bullseye. Ted Whelan had, no doubt, been alive until the instant of impact. He had had about 30 seconds to watch the Pax River Base and the Peninsula and Baltimore County and Continental America and the entire comprehensible world rise up to smash him. When they lifted his body up off the concrete, it was like a sack of fertilizer. Pete took out his bridge coat again, and he and Jane and all the little Indians went to the funeral for Ted Whelan. That it hadn't been Pete was not solace enough for Jane. That the preacher had not in fact come to her front door as the solemn friend of widows and orphans, but merely for a church call, had not brought peace and relief. That Pete still didn't show the slightest indication of thinking that any unkind fate awaited him, no longer lent her even a moment's courage. The next dream and the next hallucination and the next merely seemed more real, for she now knew. She now knew the subject and the essence of this enterprise, even though not a word of it passed anybody's lips. She even knew why Pete, the Princeton boy she had met at a debt party at the Gulf Mills Club, would never quit, never withdraw from this grim business, unless in a coffin. And God knew, and she knew. There was a coffin waiting for each little Indian. 7 years later, when a reporter and a photographer from Life magazine actually stood near her in her living room and watched her face, while outside on the lawn a crowd of television crewmen and newspaper reporters waited for a word, an indication, anything, perhaps a glimpse through a part in a curtain, waited for some sign of what she felt. When one and all asked, with their ravenous eyes and occasionally in so many words, "How do you feel? And are you scared? America wants to know." It made Jane want to laugh, but in fact, she couldn't even manage a smile. "Why ask now?" she wanted to say, but they wouldn't have had the faintest notion of what she was talking about. Chapter 2. The Right Stuff. What an extraordinary grim stretch that had been. And yet thereafter, Pete and Jane would keep running into pilots from other Navy bases, from the Air Force, from the Marines, who had been through their own extraordinary grim stretches. There was an Air Force pilot named Mike Collins, a nephew of former Army Chief of Staff J. Lawton Collins. Mike Collins had undergone 11 weeks of combat training at Nellis Air Force Base near Las Vegas. And in that 11 weeks, 22 of his fellow trainees had died in accidents, which was an extraordinary rate of 2 per week. Then there was a test pilot, Bill Bridgman. In 1952, when Bridgman was flying at Edwards Air Force Base, 62 Air Force pilots died in the course of 36 weeks of training, an extraordinary rate of 1.7 per week. Those figures were for fighter pilot trainees only. They did not include test pilots, Bridgman's own confreres, who were dying quite regularly enough. Extraordinary to be sure, except that every veteran of flying small, high-performance jets seemed to have experienced these bad strings. In time, the Navy would compile statistics showing that for a career Navy pilot, i.e., one who intended to keep flying for 20 years, as Conrad did, there was a 23% probability that he would die in an aircraft accident. This did not even include combat deaths, since the military did not classify death in combat as accidental. Furthermore, there was a better than even chance, a 56% probability to be exact, that at some point a career Navy pilot would have to eject from his aircraft and attempt to come down by parachute. In the era of jet fighters, ejection meant being exploded out of the cockpit by a nitroglycerin charge, like a human cannonball. The ejection itself was so hazardous, men lost knees, arms, and their lives on the rim of the cockpit, or had the skin torn off their faces when they hit the wall of air outside, that many pilots chose to wrestle their aircraft to the ground rather than try it, and died that way instead. The statistics were not secret, but neither were they widely known, having been eased into print obliquely in a medical journal. No pilot, and certainly no pilot's wife, had any need of the statistics in order to know the truth, however. The funerals took care of that in the most dramatic way possible. Sometimes, when the young wife of a fighter pilot would have a little reunion with a girl she went to school with, an odd fact would dawn on her. They have not been going to funerals. And then Jane Conrad would look at Pete, Princeton class of 1953. Pete had already worn his great, dark, sepulchral bridge coat more than most boys of the class of 53 had worn their tuxedos. How many of those happy young men had buried more than a dozen friends, comrades, and co-workers, lost through violent death in the execution of everyday duties? At the time, the 1950s students from Princeton took great pride in going into what they considered highly competitive, aggressive pursuits, jobs on Wall Street, on Madison Avenue, and at magazines such as Time and Newsweek. There was much fashionably brutish talk of what dog-eat-dog and cutthroat competition they found there. But in the rare instances when one of these young men died on the job, it was likely to be from choking on a chunk of Chateaubriand while otherwise blissfully boiled in an expense account restaurant in Manhattan. How many would have gone to work or stayed at work on cutthroat Madison Avenue if there had been a 23% chance, nearly one chance in four, of dying from it? Gentlemen, we're having this little problem with chronic violent death. And yet, was there any basic way in which Pete or Wally Schirra or Jim Lovell or any of the rest of them was different from other college boys his age? There didn't seem to be, other than his love of flying. Pete's father was a Philadelphia stockbroker, who in Pete's earliest years had a house in the mainline suburbs, a limousine, and a chauffeur. The Depression eliminated the terrific brokerage business, the house, the car, and the servants, and by and by his parents were divorced, and his father moved to Florida. Perhaps because his father had been an observation balloonist in the First World War, an adventurous business since the balloons were prized targets of enemy aircraft, Pete was fascinated by flying. He went to Princeton on the Holloway Plan, a scholarship program left over from the Second World War, in which a student trained with midshipmen from the Naval Academy during the summers and graduated with a commission in the regular Navy. So Pete graduated, received his commission, married Jane, and headed off to Pensacola, Florida for flight training. Then came the difference, looking back on it. A young man might go into military flight training believing that he was entering some sort of technical school in which he was simply going to acquire a certain set of skills. Instead, he found himself all at once enclosed in a fraternity. And in this fraternity, even though it was military, men were not rated by their outward ranks as ensigns, lieutenants, commanders, or whatever. No. Herein, the world was divided into those who had it and those who did not. This quality, this it, was never named, however, nor was it talked about in any way. As to what this ineffable quality was, well, it obviously involved bravery. But it was not bravery in the simple sense of being willing to risk your life. The idea seemed to be that any fool could do that, if that was all that was required, just as any fool could throw away his life in the process. No. The idea here, in the all-enclosing fraternity, seemed to be that a man should have the ability to go up in a hurtling piece of machinery and put his hide out on the line, and then have the moxie, the reflexes, the experience, the coolness to pull it back in the last yawning moment, and then to go up again the next day, and the next day, and every next day, even if the series should prove infinite. And ultimately, in its best expression, do so in a cause that means something to thousands, to a people, a nation, to humanity, to God. Nor was there a test to show whether or not a pilot had this righteous quality. There was instead a seemingly infinite series of tests. A career in flying was like climbing one of those ancient Babylonian pyramids, made up of a dizzying progression of steps and ledges, a ziggurat, a pyramid extraordinarily high and deep. And the idea was to prove at every foot of the way up that pyramid that you were one of the elected and anointed ones who had the right stuff and could move higher and higher, and even, ultimately, God willing, one day, that you might be able to join that special few at the very top, that elite, who had the capacity to bring tears to men's eyes, the very brotherhood of the right stuff itself. None of this was to be mentioned, and yet it was acted out in a way that a young man could not fail to understand. When a new flight, i.e. a class of trainees, arrived at Pensacola, they were brought into an auditorium for a little lecture. An officer would tell them, "Take a look at the man on either side of you." Quite a few actually swivel their heads this way and that in the interest of appearing diligent. Then the officer would say, "One of the three of you is not going to make it," meaning not get his wings. That was the opening theme, the motif of primary training. We already know that one-third of you do not have the right stuff. It only remains to find out who. Furthermore, that was the way it turned out. At every level in one's progress up that staggeringly high pyramid, the world was once more divided into those who had the right stuff to continue the climb and those who had to be left behind in the most obvious way. Some were eliminated in the course of the opening classroom work as either not smart enough or not hardworking enough, and were left behind. Then came the basic flight instruction and single-engine propeller-driven trainers, and a few more, even though the military tried to make this stage easy, were washed out and left behind. Then came more demanding levels, one after the other: formation flying, instrument flying, jet training, all-weather flying, gunnery, and at each level, more were washed out and left behind. By this point, easily a third of the original candidates had been, indeed, eliminated from the ranks of those who might prove to have the right stuff. In the Navy, In addition to the stages that Air Force trainees went through, the neophyte always had waiting for him, out in the ocean, a certain grim gray slab, namely the deck of an aircraft carrier, and with it, perhaps the most difficult routine in military flying, carrier landings. He was shown films about it, he heard lectures about it, and he knew that carrier landings were hazardous. He first practiced touching down on the shape of a flight deck painted on an airfield. He was instructed to touch down and gun right off. This was safe enough. The shape didn't move, at least. But it could do terrible things to, let us say, the gyroscope of the soul. That shape. It's so damn small. And more candidates were washed out and left behind. Then came the day, without warning, when those who remained were sent over the ocean for the first of many days of reckoning with the slab. The first day was always a clear day with little wind and a calm sea. The carrier was so steady that it seemed from up there in the air to be resting on pilings, and the candidate usually made his first carrier landing successfully, with relief and even elan. Many young candidates looked like terrific aviators up to that very point, and it was not until they were actually standing on the carrier deck that they first began to wonder if they had the proper stuff after all. In the training film, the flight deck was a grand piece of gray geometry, perilous to be sure, but an amazing abstract shape as one looks down upon it on the screen. And yet, once the newcomer's 2 feet were on it, geometry, my God, man, this is a skillet. It heaved. It moved up and down underneath his feet. It pitched up. It pitched down. It rolled to port. The great beast rolled, and it rolled to starboard as the ship moved into the wind and therefore into the waves, and the wind kept sweeping across 60 feet up in the air, out in the open ocean, and there were no railings whatsoever. This was a skillet, a frying pan, a short-order grill, not gray, but black, smeared with skid marks from one end to the other and glistening with pools of hydraulic fluid and the occasional jet fuel slick, all of it still hot, sticky, greasy, runny, virulent from God knows what traumas, still ablaze, consumed in detonations, explosions, flames, combustion, roars, shrieks, whines, blasts, horrible shudders, fracturing impacts, as little men in screaming red and yellow and purple and green shirts with black Mickey Mouse helmets over their ears skittered about on the surface as if their very lives, you said it now, hooking fighter planes onto the catapult shuttle so they can explode their afterburners and be slung off that deck in a red, mad fury with a kaboom that pounds through the entire deck. A procedure that seems absolutely controlled, orderly, sublime, however, compared to what he is about to watch as aircraft return to the ship for what is known in the engineering stoicisms of the military as recovery and arrest. To say that an F-4 was coming back onto this heaving barbecue from out of the sky at a speed of 135 knots, that might have been the truth in the training lecture, but it did not begin to get across the idea of what the newcomer saw from the deck itself, because it created the notion that perhaps the plane was gliding in. On the deck, one knew differently. As the aircraft came closer and the carrier heaved on into the waves and the plane's speed did not diminish and the deck did not grow steady, indeed, it pitched up and down 5 or 10 feet per greasy heave. One experienced a neural alarm that no lecture could have prepared him for. This is not an airplane coming towards me. It is a brick with some poor son of a bitch riding it. Someone much like myself, and it is not gliding. It is falling. A 30,000-pound brick headed not for a stripe on the deck, but for me. And with a horrible smash, it hits the skillet. And with a blur of momentum as big as a freight train's, it hurtles toward the far end of the deck. Another blinding storm. Another roar as the pilot pushes the throttle up to full military power and another smear of rubber screams out over the skillet. And this is nominal. Quite okay. For a wire stretched across the deck has grabbed the hook on the end of the plane as it hit the deck tail down. And the smash was the rest of the 15-ton brute slamming onto the deck as it tripped up, so that it is now straining against the wire at full throttle in case it hadn't held and the plane had bolted off the end of the deck and had to struggle up into the air again. And already the Mickey Mouse helmets are running toward the fiery monster.